I won't write down the explicit solution again, but let's just remember that basically you gave some curve, some profile function, which is this closed curve in R4, basically. And then as long, and I can take any curve as long as it's not self-intersecting, which is not that big a deal. And then I can write down a supergravity solution with D1 and D5 charge. And there was that constraint about, remember, N1 was related to the integral of F dot squared. But aside from that, it's totally unconstrained. So that's a huge number of supergravity solutions. And so the sort of general structure of these solutions, you can argue, is that it's asymptotically flat. Cross T4 cross S1. And then there's some ADS throat, is what people usually call it. And then eventually the ADS ends in some sort of cap. And this is sort of the general structure that we imagine for fuzzballs, which is for the, at least the BPS case. So it'll be asymptotically flat, but then there'll be some region where you can approximate it as ADS. And that's where the fact that it's BPS comes in. And then the geometry will end in some sense. So these, in the Luhnen-Mathur solutions, the profile function was giving the position of some sort of string of KK monopole, and so some S1 pinches off there and the geometry ends smoothly. and so if we, and then if we estimated the sort of typical size of the cap, then we found it sort of, it obeyed loosely in terms of order of magnitude, the scalings, a Bekenstein type relation when you match it up with the entropy you get from either geometric quantization or from the dual CFT description. So these would be the ground state. So these are the Luhnen-Mathur solutions, and they're dual to the Ramon-Ramon vacuum. Vacuum has two M's, U's, of the two-dimensional CFT. Okay. So it turns out that when you're in the Ramon-Ramon sector of the dual CFT, there's actually a huge ground state degeneracy, which is related to there being these twist sectors and a spin structure as well. So I mentioned at the end of yesterday that there's also an explicit map from one of these Luhnen-Mathur, any of these Luhnen-Mathur solutions to states in the CFT. So the map works something like this, as I understand it. You take your profile function and expand it in Fourier modes. And then you sort of, you just formally construct a Hilbert space or a Fock space associated with these coefficients. And then you write the corresponding coherent state for this profile function. Where these are you know, sort of the normal coherent states, which are eigenstates of the lowering operator. Okay, and this is just some state in some formal Hilbert space that we introduced by hand. We can rewrite this kind of state as in Fox space. So write it in Fox space by using these coherent states. You can write them in this form, sort of the standard result. Acting on the vacuum, so I can take this state and I can rewrite it in terms of Fox states, and then I'll just impose a constraint. So I'll write this as some product of raising operators. And then I'll impose a constraint that some ni mi is n1 and pi. So this is the charge, which is related to the central charge. Okay, and then there's an explicit mapping from each of these raising operators to operators in the CFT. And so then that gives you a precise mapping from the profile function, which is giving the geometry, to a state in the CFT. So this is outlined in Taylor and Skenderis' review, for instance. And so then you can perform, once you have such a mapping or conjecture, you can do various checks. So they focus on checking one-point functions. And they seem to agree. More generally, or earlier on, I think, Mathur and collaborators would take specific states, specific geometries, and then compute quantities like a time of flight calculation. So you drop in an excitation and see how long it takes to come out again. And then you can reproduce those results exactly from the CFT. And so this all points to the idea that there's a sort of one-to-one correspondence between these asymptotically ADS geometries and then the states in the CFT. And since we can geometrically quantize all of these solutions and count them, and it matches exactly with the ground state degeneracy, it seems like we've got all of them. So other sort of checks that people have done is you can look at sort of near extremal perturbations around specific geometries, and you can argue and then match states on both sides there. So I think that is pretty solid as far as it goes. Yeah, I haven't written up notes on that, so.
But these are gonna be perturbations to stationary states or dynamical states?
Just stationary states, I think. So this was the ADS3 cross S3 case, but there's an analogous story in the half BPS sector of ADS5 cross S5, which is the LLM geometries seem to give a complete So the LLM geometries are specified by these droplets in R2. And again, you can geometrically quantize the space of solutions when you find it matches with the half BPS degeneracy of the CFT. And so again, it looks like, and I think there's also, yeah, there's this mapping, that there is a mapping between states in the CFT and droplet functions, which then give you the geometry. So there's a nice mapping between smooth horizonless solutions in ADS and states of the CFT. So this all motivates sort of the following picture. So on one side we have our asymptotically ADS solutions, on the other side we have the conformal field theory. So the, at least in the BPS sector, it looks like you have these smooth horizonless geometries. And these are seem to be dual to states of the CFT. I can look at the whole space of such solutions in some BPS sector. So this is the supergravity solutions. And then I can geometrically quantize this space. And I get some Hilbert space. Which is isomorphic to the CFT Hilbert space. So this is one element of the Hilbert space. Then the claim is, if I coarse grain over all these this phase space, then I'm supposed to get the black hole. Which is dual to the thermal density matrix, which is averaging over all of these states. So this is the kind of picture we have in mind in the fuzzball program. So in the examples where we have all of the supergravity solutions, this, which is the Luden-Mather case, for instance, this picture seems to hold. Although here we don't have a black hole per se, we have this sort of singular BTZ geometry. There are some arguments that when you include higher derivative corrections, it'll develop sort of a small string scale horizon. Depending on the duality frame. But to be really convincing, you know, you'd like to have like a real honest large black hole. So you'd want to do the three charge case. Now it's not really, so as I mentioned, this would be sort of the picture for the strong version of the fuzzball proposal where I just have a supergravity solutions giving me my classical phase space. Most people in the fuzzball program kind of doubt that that's going to continue to hold for general black holes, that you're going to have to include sort of stringy degrees of freedom that are not captured by supergravity. But it'd be nice maybe if this were true. So it's still somewhat open. So I'll just mention, there's been a lot of work So I'm sort of transitioning from things that are very well known now to sort of more open questions and, you know, research which is now a little less definitive. So there's been a lot of work on the three charge BPS case, okay. Because as I mentioned, that has a macroscopic horizon, and it would be really convincing if we could do the same kind of story we did with the Lewin Mathers solutions in the two charge extreme. Okay. So Baena and Werner worked out the equations in terms of, you can think of it as stacks of M2 brains in M theory on wrapping different cycles of a 6 torus, for instance. So I'll just schematically write the equation. So you have these three, so it's 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 are the toroidal directions. And then this is the non-compact space. So this is, so we have these three functions, z1, z2, z3, that you have to work out. There's this one form k. And then dy squared, these are the, this is r4, and then this t is the time. And then there, you have the three form, which is given in terms of, I'll just write down the first term for you, because, yeah. There are three terms which you can sort of guess, where there's A1, A2, A3. And so I have to tell you how to solve for the A's and the Z's and K.
Sorry, out on the end, there's another factor of two Z's to the one third, so the numbers rotated.
Yeah, I forgot. Yeah. Yes, it is symmetrical. Yeah, sorry. Okay. Not working. All right. So, if you want, you could think of this as the ansatz that you could, after a bunch of arguing, you can argue as general, and then you have to look at the equations. And basically, what happens is the result, because you're looking for BPS. Solutions, the equations become effectively linear. Okay, and so this has been why there's been so much success in finding solutions for these BPS cases, because you can start with the killing spinner equations, and you get a sort of effectively linear equation. And I'll show you what I mean. So if I define, let's see, they define, theta 1, 2, and 3 as the exterior derivative of A. So A was a 1 form, so this is a 2 form, plus the exterior derivative of dt plus the one form k over z. Okay. Then you can show that there are three equations to solve. So the first one is a self-duality condition. The second one is a Poisson equation. And the third one is this kind of equation. So if you solve them in the order 1, 2, 3, then each equation is just a linear equation with sources. So you first solve this self-duality condition. Then you just have a Poisson equation. This C here is just the absolute value of the epsilon 3 index epsilon tensor. And then, again, it's a linear equation for K. And then you're done. So I'm actually not, I'm going to sort of cheat you guys. I'm not going to give you a solution. I'm just going to point out that you have this sort of linear equations that you can play with. So then the game becomes looking for solutions. And we want to find smooth horizonless solutions with no closed time-like curves. And so that imposes a set of constraints on what you can write down for these solutions. And the general solution is not known. So large, so what I should say, is there are large families of solutions, okay, which, so right now, it's, as far as I understand it, it's still an open question. Are there enough supergravity solutions to explain the three charge BPS black hole entropy? So if you try and count the sort of solutions that have been found so far, and as I said, there's sort of large families with arbitrary functions, then in terms of the asymptotic growth, it's exponential, which is good, but the coefficient is not enough, so it's still exponentially too small to explain the entropy of the black hole. But again, that's not the most general solution. And so there have been arguments by Jan de Boer et al. That there will not be enough in supergravity for the three charge black hole. And then it seems like Josef Baena and Nick Warner are saying that it's at least possible that there will be enough once you have the most general solution. Or family of solutions. So if it's not enough, then what Jan de Boer is proposing is looking at what he's called exotic brain solutions. And so as I understand it, these are, and I don't understand it that well, but these are solutions, these are geometries where you go around some closed some cycle, and instead of coming back to the same geometry, you come back to the U-dual of the geometry. And so there's these, and so they have, I think it's Jan de Boer and Masaki Shigemori have a paper talking about these exotic brain solutions or you might need some other sort of stringy objects to explain the black hole entropy. So it's an ongoing piece of work. So maybe I will stop there on the three charge.
Can I ask you
yeah.
to go back to this general picture?
Uh-huh.
Is the step at the bottom there called coarse graining? Do we have a good picture of that even for the two charge?
No.
Okay.
There's been a lot of work on it, and So, in particular, Vijay Balasubramanian has done some work on that, and Jan de Boer. So, you know, there's some arguments, and as I recall, what I remember reading was that they could argue that they could get sort of the geometry that looked like the black hole solution. So they would get a geometry which was not a solution to Einstein's equations. And it looked like the black hole solution, except it had some exponential factor, which was not, let's see, it was like e to the minus r, and so instead of like 1 or something like that. It looked close to, in some sense, the black hole solution. So yeah, people have done some work on that. Nothing's been 100% convincing, and it would be interesting if we could understand that. I mean, there's a lot of questions whether it's even possible. You know, if there's some, like, what is the metric on the space here that you're averaging? And
well, does the geometric quantization give you hints as to what that other stuff? I mean, somehow that seems to be well understood.
Right.
Telling us something about the structure.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's an open problem.
Okay.
And people have done some work on it, and I haven't followed it as closely enough to really answer your question. You could also sort of try and work a different angle, which would be to go over the CFT side, and of course we know exactly what we're doing here. So you can try and sort of figure out what that means on the other side.
Let me ask a kind of related, just physical intuition question on this. In terms of, so if there really is what you're calling the strong fuzzball proposal, and there's really smooth geometry there, why am I getting confused about, why don't I just see it as a classical geometry if I fall in? Why do I think it's a black hole?
So, I
as
think
opposed to any other solution,
right? So I think part of the argument would be that the black hole solution is sick. I mean, it has the singularity, and what happens is when I look at these the geometries that I have. To sort of get intuition. They all use sort of the extra dimensions in a non-trivial way, where the extra dimension is, you know, there's some compact direction which is fibered in a non-trivial way, for instance. And so if I try and work from the lower dimensional perspective, I don't understand it. You know, it's not just like there's some Kluze-Klein excitations. So it really, to explain that the entropy of the black hole, or to build these microstates, I really have to know that there are these extra dimensions and that there are these stringy degrees of freedom. I don't know if you look.
I'm not sure that answers that.
Okay.
I think within your program, I think I agree with everything. Say, although I guess your proposition really is, if I collapse ordinary matter into this is what I really get.
That's right, yeah.
That I'm somehow going to form all these non-trivial cycles and all this stuff.
Right.
In regions of low curvature.
That's the claim.
you can't say, can you say anything more about that? So that means we're going to need topology changes on large scales?
Yes.
All this kind of stuff.
Yes, that would be the claim. I think.
Not to distract you too much from where you
are. Yeah. Obviously it's speculative because these are all sort of extremal states. Really, you want to ask a dynamical question, and so I have to extrapolate. So that was part of what that argument I gave about tunneling was about. Whereas, if you start with some like shell of matter that's collapsing, and you could ask, how does it ever get into one of these fuzzball geometries? If I think about like tunneling, it should be exponentially suppressed. But then the idea was that it would sort of that there are so many different things it could tunnel into, that those two, the exponentially small amplitude for tunneling is sort of counteracted by the exponentially number of ways to tunnel. And so that it could, that collapsing shell would just sort of tunnel into some superposition of these fuzzball geometries.
Keep going.
Yeah.
You made the statement.
Okay.
Just since we stopped you.
Yeah, please.
Is there a less radical departure in that? You talked about its near extremal perturbations or excitations. I mean, if you started with one of these and just threw a small graviton or something at it.
Yeah.
Do we know?
So there are people.
Do we have an idea of what happens when it hits the end? I know there were these time of flight calculations, but do we have a more developed picture of tunneling to other states? Or?
No, that was something personally I wanted to work on, and I haven't had a chance to. Was trying if I could understand this sort of tunneling picture more concretely. So next I was going to talk about JMART, which sort of led to some ideas about how the non-extremal case could work. But certainly, what I was saying before was that you can look at sort of small excite. You can look at excitations in one of these backgrounds so that it's in near extremal. And then you can match states in the CFT in the same way. And you can see that they don't just suddenly develop a horizon or anything like that. So that at least is consistent with this picture. Yeah. So, I should really emphasize that I think most people at this point don't really believe the strong form of the fuzzball proposal for a general non-extremal black hole. I think most people would believe that it's going to be very stringy and involve Planck scale physics and may not have a geometric description at all. But so then the key claim is just that these microstates extend on the horizon scale and are built out of a stringy degrees of freedom.
So just so I'm clear, so that you're saying in general we're going to have Planck scale curvature in the region of the would-be horizon. Okay.
Yes. Okay. So yeah, one direction we can try and push this is to go to the three-charge BPS case, where we have macroscopic entropy, and we can really, if we could do that case, then that would be very convincing maybe for some people. On the other hand, sort of the other direction to push is to go away from extremality, And so there's been some progress in that direction, and so I'm going to talk about the story we have for the JMART solutions, which I think probably Rob Myers is very familiar with. So the JMART solutions. Why are they called that, first of all? So it's Tjalla, Madden, Ross, and Titchener. And I forget who decided to call it JMART, but that's what people call it these days. So they found a family of three-charge non-extremal geometries, which I can think of as being parameterized by three integers. Which I'll call n, n bar, and kappa. And so this is a very special kind of solution that you can make by spectral flow, basically. If you don't know what that is, it doesn't matter. Anyway. So they have the same sort of general structure, and so I'm going to draw the same cartoon as I've been drawing, where it's asymptotically flat, 4 plus 1 dimensional Minkowski, and then S1 cross T4. And then there's some ADS region, as long as you take the size of the S1 to be large. And then the geometry caps off. And in the cap, there's some Erger region. Okay. So these parameters n and n bar, you can think of as controlling originally they came from sort of spectral flow, and so it's how the flat asymptotic flat space sort of connects up with the ADS geometry, and that's sort of what controls this Erger region here. Kappa, if kappa is, basically you get a Z kappa orbifold geometry, and so if kappa is just one, then it, there's no orbifold. If it's bigger than one, then there's an orbifold. So what is an Erger region? So an Erger region is where instead of, with a black hole, you can think of it, when you reach the horizon, the light cones all tip over in the radial direction and you're forced inexorably inward. With an Erger region, the light cones all tip over but in sort of an angular direction, and so you're forced to rotate with respect to infinity, but you can still escape the Erger region without any trouble. So these geometries were found by JMART, and it was sort of natural to think of them as some, albeit very non-typical or atypical, microstates of some non-extremal black hole. So at least people within the fuzzball community might want to say that. However, later it was shown that there's an instability associated with this geometry. I think it was Cardoso, Myers, and
Diaz.
Okay, thank you. So this is in 2B string theory, and so what I can do is I can take gravitons with legs on T4, and you can actually show up to some factor that these are minimal scalars with respect to the remaining geometry. So these are the minimally coupled scalar is an actual excitation in string theory. So what you can do is you can solve the minimal scalar wave equation, which is just box psi equals 0. So you could look for solutions of this form. Okay, just take an ansatz like this. And then what you find is there are solutions with positive, with omega with imaginary part. With the way I've written it, omega I is greater than zero. So it's growing exponentially in time. So I start with some, you know, the slightest perturbation, and it just grows exponentially in time. Eventually, I have to back react on the geometry, and so the geometry is going to decay. So this is a classical instability. So you can find the spectrum in a large R limit using matched asymptotic expansions. And you find, so lambda is the momentum on the S1. So I'll write it in this way. And then there's combinatorial factors. So it's n plus l plus 1 choose l plus 1, and n bar, capital N bar, plus l plus 1 choose l plus 1. Sorry if you can't see that last factor. And then A, what I've called A here is so I'll explain the notation in a second. So the capital N's, if you're wondering, are sort of like the radial quantum numbers, so they're not parameters in the geometry. L, M psi, and M phi are just the angular harmonic that of the particular mode that we're talking about. Okay, so N and N, capital N and capital N bar are some integers. R is the radius of the S1, which I need to take large to have a nice ADS. Okay, I think that explains everything. So this is the spectrum. And so there is a question about whether this, if I think of this as some microstate, of a non-extremal black hole, then how do I interpret this instability? So one sort of natural guess would be that this would be sort of the microscopic analog of Hawking radiation. But then it seems like it's way too fast because it's a classical instability, whereas Hawking's a very slow quantum process. But what we'll argue is, in fact, it's exactly if you go to a CFT description, it's exactly the same process as Hawking radiation. It's just that this particular state is extremely atypical, and so there's an enhancement. Basically a Bose enhancement effect that sort of makes it a classical. So this was all argued by Chowdhury and Mather in three papers, and then I think more conclusively shown in two papers with myself, Chowdhury and Mather, and one Mather and one with just me and Rune Chowdhury, where we took kappa greater than 1 in that last paper. For the rest, it was just cap equals 1. Okay. So the way the picture works is you can show that this instability, yeah, let me explain the instability actually. So you have this ergo region, okay, so the geometry in some sense has this rotation to it. And then if you look at the form the solution takes, basically you get excitations leaving and carrying energy and angular momentum out of the geometry. And then the part that's left is tending to cancel out and reduce the energy of the solution. And so you can think of it, the decay process in this way. So it has a sort of pair creation kind of description. You can show that the solution has zero field theory norm, and so it's consistent. Okay, so the argument that this is actually the same process as Hawking radiation is that we go to a CFT description and we reproduce exactly this spectrum using the same kind of coupling that you would use to get the Hawking radiation, including gray body factors. So what we're going to do is it's something people don't usually do with ADS CFT. So I'll take my asymptotically flat solution and then with some ADS throat, and then I'll imagine I put some cutoff on the ADS, which I'll call RB. And so the claim is that the geometry down here is dual to a CFT. So I can sort of replace that with just some CFT here connected up to flat space. Okay.
Are you going to make it a leaky CFT in some sense? Or
what was that?
So the one normal problem with this is, you know, stuff, matter can travel in and out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not going to have a normal concern.
Well, there's still a decoupling limit if I go.
Only by hand, right? I mean, no, I can have some particle that falls in there.
No, there's a centrifugal barrier. So if I have low energy excitations, they don't get in very easily.
Okay.
I mean, you can think of the decoupling limit in that if you look at like a scalar wave equation, for instance, and one of these black brain backgrounds, you can argue that there's sort of this energy-dependent potential barrier between the sort of ADS region and then the asymptotic flat region. And so that it's actually suppressed as you go to low energies.
OK, so I'm only supposed to take this seriously in kind of a low energy limit, or?
That's the regime where you have Hawking. Is that the Hawking radiation? I'm not sure. I don't know.
I don't think whether the coupling is strong or weak is not going to bother me too much in my calculation between the flat space and the CFT. Hold on a second. Let me just. Yeah, no. If I take the size of the S1 to be large, which I want to anyway, so that the ADS region is big in an appropriate sense, then it's suppressed by like the energy E squared minus lambda squared, lambda is the momentum, over the radius of that S1. So yeah, I will take energy to be lower than, in that sense,
okay.
If you like. Okay. So how do I set this up? So the idea is that here, so this sort of joining region between the flat and the ADS, I'll call them neck. I never particularly like that because I have a throat, ADS throat, and then neck. Anyway, that's what people call it, I guess. So I can imagine breaking up the action formally into three parts. And then basically the claim is that the ADS part I can replace a CFT, and then I'll have some interaction term, which is related in part with the physics of the neck, and then the flat space. So we have this famous formula for ADS CFT, that the partition function of the CFT with some source term, classical source term, is given by, if you like, the path integral in ADS with the boundary value of the field being the classical source, the CFT. So there's the first thing we have to do is we have to fix this constant mu. And so we can do that by normalizing the operators in the CFT. So for instance, we'll take their two-point function to be unity at unit separation in some units. And then I can compute that two-point function in the ADS and then demand that it agrees, and then that fixes the constant mu. And so it's some complicated function depending on the dimension and the conformal dimension of the operator in the CFT. So if you want, you can think, if you like, you can think of that as sort of this mu is sort of the coupling between the CFT and then the value of the field phi b, which if you like is by continuity is just the value of the field right here. So then what the only thing we have to do is we have to sort of include the physics of the neck and ask the question, if I start with a wave out here, how much of it makes it to the CFT? And so you can work that out, and you get the interaction in terms of some, this is some derivative operator. I'll tell you a little bit about it. And then this is this vertex operator in the CFT. So CL, this is some dimensionful constant. It's this constant mu that we talked about before, some other factor, and then it scales with where you put RB. The delta minus d. Delta is the conformal dimension of the CFT operator. So this phi here is the flat space field. And so this is some lth order derivative operator, which just picks out the Lm harmonic when you evaluated it at r equals 0. It's sort of related to some Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, if you like. let's see. So I guess we'll go over here. So the picture, I guess this is middle, we have is that so we've gone to a sort of an approximation where I have flat space, and then right at r equals 0, I have the CFT living at a point. And so that's going to include all the physics of the neck, and then the ADS. And then, so what we want to do is we can use that interaction, and we'll look at an amplitude which has some final state of the CFT, some final state of the flat space, and some initial state of the flat space, which will just be the vacuum, and some initial state in the CFT. And you can use that to compute a decay amplitude, d gamma dE, so the emission rate, basically, of the CFT into flat space, in terms of just some CFT correlator. So here's this suppression of energy with respect to R that I was talking about. And then you have energy conserving delta functions. Okay. So the problem just gets reduced to computing some correlation function in the CFT here. And for the kappa equals 1 case, using some CFT tricks, namely spectral flow, you can write this amplitude as just, this way right here, a vacuum-to-vacuum transmission, a transition, which is like L minus 1 to the n, capital N. So capital N, remember, was that like radial quantum number. And a two-point function of these Vs. And so basically, this kind of correlator is completely fixed by conformal invariance. And so it's easy to work out. And so you can plug it in. And you get exactly reproduce the spectrum that we found in supergravity up there. So what? So the thing is, if I use this exact same coupling, okay, and then instead of putting the CFT in some particular state, which was dual to this Jmar geometry, if instead I put it in a thermal state and then compute the emission rate, then I exactly reproduce the Hawking radiation with gray body factors. So it's the exact same interaction between flat space and the CFT, the same vertex operator in the CFT, which reproduces and seems to be responsible for Hawking radiation. And so if this is one particular microstate that has this instability, then it seems to be sort of the Hawking process for this one atypical state. Okay.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
So this correspondence, so did we decide whether it's only valid for low energies or high energies?
So here I see this suppression of energy with respect to R, the size of the S1. So I think of this as exactly the decoupling limit. And I think I do want the interaction. I am sort of doing this in first order in perturbation theory, so I should be sort of weakly coupled between the flat space and the CFT. Otherwise, I could worry about doing higher level, basically loops. If you want.
So because I mean, just in the low energy, all you have from Hawking radiation are gray body factors. I mean, there isn't.
Right.
You don't have the exponential part of the low energy.
Right. Yeah, I'll have to look. If I mean it's so low that I don't see that exponential factor, I feel like I do. I mean,
you do see it.
I do. I think I feel like you do see it. So this calculation was done. Okay, not in exactly this way, but Maldacena and Strominger did this, for instance, in the late 90s, I think, and they showed that you get the Hawking radiation with gray body factors. And I thought, I recall there being some cinch there that I think is the exponential that you're talking about. I don't have my notes on that calculation right here, so I can't. But
well, I guess the question is, what is low energy? Is that something like some Springer scale, or lower than some Springer scale, or lower than the size of the black hole?
No, I just lower than this. It's suppressed by the radius, the size of the S1. So.
So that could be very small.
Well, what happens is if I want the ADS region to be deep in some sense, and so I expect the approximation of, so this approximation that this is asymptotic ADS is good, then I need to take the size of the S1 to be large anyway.
Okay.
And so I think that ties in naturally with the decoupling limit. And so I think I just need the energy to be much, you know, less than R.
Okay. Is that combination Q1, Q5 over R squared, is that the ADS radius squared?
Good question. Sorry, hold on a second. Yeah, hold on. I can answer you. Yeah, no, I think that's right. Yeah, it's Q1, Q5 to the... Right.
Where is it?
Sorry. Yeah, Q1, Q5 to the 1/4 is the...
Oh, 1/4.
Yeah. Radius of the S3, I think. Which is tied to the radius, the ADS. Yeah. Okay. So, for the kappa equals one case, it reduced just to this two-point function. Which is just fixed by conformal invariance. And so we can compute it at any point in the moduli space of the CFT. There's sort of a weakly coupled CFT that we'd like to work with, and you can use that, for instance, to think about it. For higher kappa, it becomes a three-point function. And so it's a little less clear that the calculation at weak coupling weakly coupled CFT should match, but it does. It may be related to some non-normalization theorems. I don't know that the agreement is precisely understood. Yeah. But it does work. Okay. So, motivated by this success, there's some ideas about, you know, how non-extremal fuzzballs and sort of a general case might work. So if you look back at like the Lunin Mathur solution, where you have this profile function, you can show that the time-like killing vector at infinity, it actually becomes null right on that curve. Okay, and so if you like that sort of, when the time-like killing vector becomes space-like, then you have an Erker region. So there's sort of an idea that if I move away from extremality, maybe I'll generically get, I'll generically not have a global time-like killing vector, and I will have these sort of ergo regions, which will have some sort of instability similar to this one, although presumably it would be much slower for a typical state.
Why do you think it goes that way as opposed to the other?
Motivated by this. I think you have this curve, and so you can imagine if I put in some wave or something, that at least in some places it would make it space-like, and other places it would make it time-like. If I sort of perturb the geometry in some arbitrary way.
Well, in some sense we're heating up, some sense I expect less ergo region.
Hmm.
So that's the intuition I would offer.
So I don't know, it's very speculative.
If you have hot, if you heat something up, there is less ergo region, why is that?
Well, essentially, you effectively have an ergo region, is effectively got a region of essentially negative energy because it's spinning.
Yeah.
So, in some sense, you go hotter, you have less of that. This is a heuristic.
I don't think actually it has much to do with the spin here. I mean, I think it's just, it's a very non-spherical situation.
Well, if it weren't spinning, I don't think you would have any.
Ergo
region. If it wasn't a spinning, it wouldn't have. But I mean, that's for a Kerr black hole. But
I
mean,
well, I think it's
general,
as a general statement. Maybe you disagree with it.
Well, I think if in the sort of example I'm imagining, I have this very complicated profile function.
Sure.
So it's not necessarily spinning, but some sort of. I mean, there's some dynamical aspect of the geometry in this complicated way that it wouldn't naturally be just angular momentum like it is for this example or
for it's certainly a lot more complicated than the curve black hole or anything like that. That's true.
Yeah. As I said, it's very speculative. And we probably think that the actual typical microstate of a non-extremal black hole is going to be not have a good supergravity description, so your mileage may vary, I guess. But that's sort of one idea about how that Hawking radiation would work out of a typical non-extremal microstate. So I think I'll just close with a few, just listing some sort of open questions in the fuzzball program and sort of mention some directions people are going in. And then finish hopefully with some time. Oops, that's not. Let's see. Oh. Ah. So maybe I can do this. Okay. So I think, as I've tried to emphasize, one of the big questions is supergravity enough? So will I find a classical phase space of solutions within supergravity for the three-charge black hole, for a general BPS black hole, for a general non-extremal black hole? And I think most people think probably not. that you're going to have, you know, that you're going to have to go to more exotic, sort of stringy description. Another question is, when should I use, you know, what? When should I use these microstates, and when should I use the black hole solution? So, for instance, if I'm falling in, to a black hole, do I use the sort of black hole solution, which is supposed to be the average in some sense, or do I use one of these fuzzball, the sort of typical fuzzball geometry? Or they might give different answers, okay? And so, of course, that directly bears on this whole firewall question, which, by the way, there's like three more papers on it today. So yes, conversations that are ongoing on that. The other question that people have was, what if I take, you know, ideally you'd want to look at like Schwarzschild, but you know, what are the typical microstates like? So JMR was supposed to be a microstate of some non-extremal black hole, but it's not supposed to be sort of the typical microstate. And so it doesn't have properties that are very similar to the black hole. So you have this large classical instability, for instance.
So can you clarify what this, with the first question of supergravity? I mean, we know that we don't have supergravity in this room, so, right?
No, what he means by that is how much you need stringy ingredients beyond supergravity. So this room is presumably a good truncation of supergravity. We'll get an excited extra supersymmetric matter or something.
Well, but I mean, I guess my question is, I mean, you also, there's a lot of stuff happening that we need, that we know supergravity, well, much lower masses. I'm not quite sure.
So yeah, I mean, all of that will be going on, and I think the question would be, is there a configuration space within supergravity that explains the entropy of the black hole, for instance, or do I have to go to some? Do I have to include other stringy degrees of freedom or stringy effects, which are not there in supergravity, to account for the entropy of the black hole? It may, I mean, just like you can account for the entropy in this room, the molecules of gas in this room, fairly well with some classical picture of molecule here, molecule there, so on. I don't need to go to some quantum description or a more detailed description. That's a useful description for doing thermodynamics, for instance, at large temperatures.
Yeah, I guess my concern is kind of the opposite, is that the stuff below the scale of stringier scales, like, I don't know, peaks, or I mean, also everything else that we have, the massive particles. So, I mean, you don't never talk about them. I guess this is a supersymmetric theory. Is that, am I understanding this or not?
Yeah, I mean, we're mostly looking at supersymmetric black holes. But I guess your question is, if I think about for the real world,
yeah.
Supposing I had some way of embedding the four-dimensional world I see into string theory, and then I made a Schwarzschild black hole.
Mm-hmm.
What would the microstates look like there?
Yeah,
yeah, I mean that's.
What's so spaced down?
I have no idea. I'd
love to be able to answer you, but.
But I guess that's the question that you're not even asking. But.
Yeah. I mean, that's I mean, even the first part of that, right, is still quite open, whether how to embed like the Stern model in string theory.
Well, so far you've only talked about five-dimensional black holes.
Yes.
So, it's a little bit away.
So we need to reduce dimension by one, introduce massive particles, I stand on model, blah, blah, okay.
Yeah. Make sure I get SU3 across SU2 across
SU3. We have more basic things to worry about first. Yeah.
But, I mean, string theory is supposed to be a consistent theory of quantum gravity. So, even in these toy problems, which maybe don't look anything like black holes in the real world, it should resolve. You know, I should be able to ask these questions and hopefully get enlightening answers. Okay. So related to this point, so what uses the black hole solution? You could ask about the Euclidean sort of saddle point. So what's the relationship? To the Euclidean picture and some of the precision counting that's been done, and it's usually done in this Euclidean picture. So, you know, for instance, Sen and various other people have been, you know, taking these doing these precision counts, which are very impressive. And so, in some sense, they should be counting these fuzzballs, but they've gone to the Euclidean picture, and so then the connection gets a little less clear. I don't know whether there is going to be anything concrete that you can say, but maybe there is. I think another good question is there a general argument why you get the area law within this fuzzball picture. So I think that is a good question. And then finally, I think an important question which maybe hasn't been asked enough is what are the sort of theoretical and I'll put experimental in quotes, consequences. So just as sort of a thought experiment, what do I have to do in principle to distinguish, you know, if I had a black hole in this room, how could I tell that it's a fuzzball and not a black hole? You know, if I think that I can really just use, you know, for most observables, it looks like a black hole because it's some coarse graining. Then, you know, what sort of experiment would I have to design so that I could tell that it's not?
I think you just said it's five-dimensional, so if you have one extra dimension.
Okay.
It's fairly easy. It's relatively easy.
Yeah, so I think I'll stop there, and then if you guys have more questions, then I'm happy to answer them.
Well, that's thanks, Steve.
So let me press you a little on your first point. So I might have said, okay, I've got some region of limited energy, and if I'm going to have supergravity break down in the usual way, the string coupling is getting big, which probably is not as an essential part of the story, or Planck scale curvatures are getting large. But if I have Planck scale curvatures over, you know, huge macroscopy region, that takes a huge amount of energy, or I'm really dealing with a theory where those are magically canceling out, in which case I start to get very worried. I can do this in general. My theory has gradients that have the wrong directions, probably embedded from below. I'm in real trouble. Is the concern clear, or?
Well, I think the idea is that if I have some,
or do you have some different idea on how supergravity is breaking down for different reasons?
Well, so certainly, yeah, I can worry about the dilaton, in getting some large G-string corrections. And then also, but I think, you know, when I have, if I imagine I have like the some D-brains or whatever stringy excitations, then I think generically when I get close to them, I expect to see sort of string scale curvature. This is the argument I'm used to hearing.
And apply some curvature that, in some rough sense, you know, integrate that up, and that would normally produce a lot of energy. So the question is, how can that possibly work?
Mm-hmm.
Unless the you know, the area is shrinking to zero, or it's, well, in most of those cases, you're either ending up with this one which doesn't have that curvature, i.e., an infinite ABS throat, or something that's a naked singularity where I can't really ask all these questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, I th- there. I mean, there may be some sort of redshifting. I don't know.
An independent thought I have.
Yeah.
There's another instability which you may or may not know about of infinite variables at ABS regions, that is, once you go away from extremality, you get a double horizon, and you have an inner horizon, which is unstable.
Mm-hmm.
So has that been thought about in this?
Not that I know.
Yeah, presumably that should show.
If there's
the
no horizon, then what are we talking about?
Okay, so the point is, if we take this thing with this, if we know this is true for a black hole, if we heat it up a little bit away from extremality, the thing's unstable because of the instability of the horizon.
Yeah.
Well, it's pilot horizon. So if that's an incorrect force string description of these finer things, then that you should see that same phenomenon.
Right. No, that's a good question. And as far as I know, I don't think anyone's
but
looked
at that. I don't quite follow, because I thought in the possible picture there is no horizon. So what
about if I first spray over a bunch of these things, it's supposed to reproduce a black hole.
Yeah.
That's the whole
idea. So that's one idea. Okay.
Well, that's not true that the fuzz balls aren't related to black holes.
Even the inside of the black hole, is that because I thought that was more of a speculation than actually. So the outside, I thought that was clear, but the inside, I thought that was, maybe you guys were all convinced in the last day, but inside is there as well.
But to bring the question back to Steve,
I mean,
you didn't mention firewalls or black hole interiors.
Well,
is there
thinking
a party line, or is that just open for discussion along with everyone else? You know?
I think implicitly that was sort of in the back of my mind when I was writing these questions.
Okay.
For instance, in this question, you know, if I have an infalling observer, isn't there a sense in which I get to use the black hole solution?
Okay.
And do I just fall through?
Okay.
Samir has definitely been pushing this idea of fuzzball complementarity. As far as an idea that that maybe you could fall in, it looks like maybe it could work, but then as I was trying to point out, it looks like you could still run the firewall argument. So after the page time, it looked like you got into the same trouble. But that's just one point of view. I mean, I think all the people that work on fuzzballs have a slightly different perspective. So I would sort of hesitate to give a party line for anything, because
what's Steve Avery's bet? At 3:30 on June.
So I keep going back and forth on the firewall argument, but I haven't looked at the papers that came out today, but I still feel like I haven't seen a convincing evasion. And so I don't find the idea that the idea that the fuzz balls are some sort of microstates associated with the barrels, that seems appealing to me. But you do have to be careful if you're going to say there's a firewall. Then you have to make sure that you can still have black hole thermodynamics and various other calculations that should go through in the way we expect. Otherwise, you're sort of tossing the baby out with the bathwater. So that's sort of what I lean toward, but I could be convinced either way.
Well, there's a lull. So let's thank Steve again.